The Lord be with you. A reading from the Holy Gospel according to St. Luke. Jesus said to his disciples, "A rich man had a steward who was reported to him for squandering his property. He summoned him and said, 'What is this I hear about you? Prepare a full account of your stewardship because you can no longer be my steward.' The steward said to himself, 'What shall I do now that my master is taking the position of steward away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm too ashamed to beg. I know what I shall do, so that when I am removed from the stewardship, they may welcome me into their homes.' He called his master's debtors in one by one. To the first he said, 'How much do you owe my master?' He replied, 100 measures of olive oil. He said to him, 'Here is your promissory note. Sit down and quickly write one for 50. Then to another the steward said, "And you, how much do you owe?" He replied, 100 cores of wheat. The steward said to him, "Here is your promissory note. Write one for 80. And the master commended that dishonest steward for acting shrewdly. For the children of this world are more prudent in dealing with their own generation than are the children of light. I tell you, make friends for yourselves with dishonest wealth, so that when it fails you, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. For the person who is trustworthy in very small matters is also trustworthy in great ones. And the person who is dishonest in very small matters is also dishonest in great ones. If therefore you are not trustworthy with dishonest wealth, who will trust you with true wealth? If you're not trustworthy with what belongs to another, who will give you what is yours? No servant can serve two masters. He will either hate one and love the other, or be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and mammon." The Gospel of the Lord. This Sunday's Gospel contains what is probably the most confusing parable in any part of the Gospel. It almost seems as if Jesus is praising a crooked business manager for his wily deception. It appears that he who gave us the commandment, "Thou shalt not steal," is himself praising someone for violating it, if violating it is in one's own self-interest. But Jesus clearly can't be doing that. What's he trying to teach us? In order to answer that question, we first have to grasp what's happening in the story and then what application Jesus would be making to us through that story. The first is, what's really going on? A manager is about to get fired because he was squandering the property of his master. His master gave him his pink slip and told him to do an audit of the books prior to his dismissal. So the man called in those who owed his master money or things and reduced their debts considerably. At first glance, this seems like dishonesty, like he's stealing from his boss. But it's really not. In the ancient world, they used to handle commissions differently than we handle them today. For example, if you're a real estate agent today and you put your market on the house for $200,000, let's keep fees and stuff on the side for now. But if you were selling it for $200,000 and your real estate agent was getting a 6% commission, that would mean you get $188,000 and the real estate agent gets $12,000. In the ancient world, it was different. If you were selling something for 200 denarii, that is what you'd get from the sale. Whoever was going to be selling it as your broker would tack on top of it whatever the broker thought he or she could make. So they might sell it for 212 denarii, or 220, or 250, or 300, whatever they thought they could get. You'd get your 200, and they'd get the rest. So, when this steward calls in those who owed his master and cut it down from 100 to 50 or 100 to 80, what he was almost certainly doing was eliminating his commission. And that's what was being praised by the master in the parable and through the master's voice, also God. Faced with the decision of saving his life by making friends who would take care of him after he was fired, or trying to hold out to the end for the possibility of squeezing a last penny out of commissions, this steward in the gospel chose to save his life. And Jesus calls that prudent and wise. What's the application to us? It's actually quite stark and shocking. Each of us is that steward. God has given us tremendous gifts on the basis of which we've made profits, or tried to. He's given us our hands, which we use to work. He's given us our brains, which we use to think. He's given us our family and friends, our education, our lives, and so many other blessings. With these great gifts, we've profited and made for ourselves a manifold commission. Almost everything we have and we have earned is a result of the principle God gave us. But none of those profits is meant strictly for ourselves. It's for building up the Master's kingdom. And Jesus is implying that rather than use them for that purpose, many of us have been using those gifts to enrich ourselves, and we've been squandering what's most important. So the Master comes and says that we've been wasting his gifts, and our time is coming to an end. That we need to prepare an accounting of how we've used the gifts of life and the talents and blessings he's bestowed upon us. This will happen at the end of our life when our term of stewardship is up. Each of us has misused that principle, those gifts, each time we've used them selfishly. Each time we've put ourselves first and the master second or lower. Each time we've used them for ends not compatible with the kingdom. Each time we've sinned. What can we do about it? Jesus tells us very clearly in the parable. We should do exactly what the steward did. Use the profits we tried to gain selfishly from the gifts he has given us, and give those profits to others to take care of them, so that we might be taken care of in return, so that they might remember us, they might be our advocates, our supporters before the throne of Almighty God, and welcome us into eternal homes, to use Jesus' phrase. The implication Jesus is giving us is that if we don't want to do the right thing simply because it's the right thing to do, if we don't want to be charitable to others because we're filled with God's love, we should do it as a divine CYA in order to protect our own self-interest, because unless we're charitable to others, we go to hell. Those are the words of Jesus. He wants us to do it for the right motivation. But even if we're struggling to have that motivation to love those we're caring for, we have to do it. And that's what he's trying to inspire us today. We, like the steward in the parable, are faced with the choice between holding on to the stuff and using it for ourselves or trying to save our lives eternally. We can't take money or possessions with us as we go. The only thing that'll fit through the eye of the needle are acts of love. The poor, in essence, are our bankers. The only thing we can take into eternity is what we put into their hands. If we use whatever God has given us in this world for charity, at our judgment and after it, those whom we have helped, including family members, will be among the first to welcome us to the eternal home of heaven. Jesus will turn to us and he will say that whatever we did to them, we did to him. That he took it personally. So even if we're not moved out of a good heart to help someone less fortunate, we should at least do it out of self-interested prudence, because each of us is going to have to render an account. We can't serve both God and money. We have to make the choice. And the Lord wants us to make a good one, like the steward did. That choice is either to try to serve money and grow that wealth, or to serve God and others and grow a wealth that the IRS can't tax. I learned a very important lesson yesterday. It really touched me, from my nephew Dominic. On Friday night at the Booster Club banquet, Dominic won the second jackpot, which was for $500. And so I called him on Saturday morning to let him know that he was very lucky. Called my brother's cell phone. They were all at my niece's soccer game. And I said, "Scott, is Dominic there?" "Yeah. Can I talk to him?" "Sure. Why?" I said, "He won $500 last night." So Scott passes the cell phone to Dominic and said, "Your Uncle Raj wants to tell you you won something really big last night." So he comes, "Hi, Uncle Raj." I said, "Dominic, I've got really good news for you." "Yeah, my dad told me." "What is it?" I said, "Dominic, how happy would you be if I said you won $100? "Really happy, Uncle Raj." "What if I said 200? "Even happier." "300? "Even happier." "400? "Stop, Uncle Raj." "No, what if you won 400? "I'd be really happy." "What about 450? 475? 490? 499? "How about 500? And he screams, "I'd be really happy." I said, "Well, Dominic, you won $500. And he screams with his little young, "Yay!" Then I asked him, "Dominic, what do you think you're going to do with the money?" I expected that he would say something like, "Well, I want to buy this, or maybe I'll put it in the bank." Those are the normal responses I get from kids. Dominic's response, I'll never forget. He said, "Uncle Roger, I think I'm going to find 500 people and give them each a dollar." I remembered something that happened at the beginning of August. My nieces and nephews had all come down because they were celebrating my aunt's convalidation. She'd married outside of the church many years ago, and after 27 years, I was able to bless her marriage after she received an annulment. So after the wedding in the chapel here, we went down to Calderas for a little reception. And during that reception, my aunt and uncle went around to each of the great nieces and nephews to give them something to thank them for coming, kind of as if they were the members of their bridal parties, right? And so they gave each of them $10, went around to my other niece and nephews, and they were all polite. "Thank you very much, Aunt Elaine. Thank you, Uncle Duane." And immediately they tucked that money away. Dominic was the last, and he happened to be seated right next to me. And as soon as he received those $10, he looked up and he smiled and he thanked them with a beautiful smile. Then as soon as they had returned, he said, "Uncle Roger, could you use these $10? He wanted to give it immediately to his uncle for the needs of the church. This is what Jesus is talking about. All that we have are gifts given to us in order to be shared with others. Last week on pilgrimage, I was able to bring the pilgrims to Ars, the place where St. John Vianney, the patron saint of priests, lived and worked for 41 years. And he said that all our blessings are a divine depository placed in our hands. We're supposed to use whatever he gives us for others. Why does Jesus use the term dishonest wealth in the gospel? He doesn't mean ill gain. He doesn't mean that you earned it by selling drugs or robbing banks. Dishonest means untrue wealth. It's the equivalent of monopoly money. It seems like it's real, but it's not. There is a true wealth, and the true riches that Jesus talks about are the ones that aren't going to prove to be counterfeit at the end of time. Those are those deeds of love, those real spiritual riches that we can take with us when we go. The key is, in what do we really place our value, and what treasure are our hearts really seeking? Since that conversation 25 hours ago with my little nephew Dominic, I've been asking myself that question. Am I as charitable as my 7-year-old nephew? Am I even as smart in what really matters as little Dominic? It's a question that Jesus wants each of us to ask this weekend. Jesus tells us that the children of this age are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the children of light. We're the children of light, and he's saying in comparison to the children of the age, those who are worldly, we're stupid. We're idiots. We're fools. He was saying that the people who are worldly are often much more prudent than believers when it comes to making choices that concern their survival. Our experience shows us how right Jesus is. Successful businessmen and women will work very hard to improve their companies and maximize their profits. We're called to work even harder to improve our soul and eternal portfolio. Business people, if they know that a certain practice, a certain division of their company, a certain employee is losing them money, they try to remedy it right away. They don't fool around. And if they can't, they eliminate it. They know that in order to survive, they need to cut their losses. Otherwise, they'll end up in chapter 11. Many of us Christians, however, when we know that a practice is losing us God's grace, seldom act in such a decisive and intelligent way. Even though a serious sin might send us into eternal bankruptcy, we often don't get rid of it. Jesus instructs us with bottom line brutality in the Sermon on the Mount, but few of us follow his free advice. If your right eye is causing you to sin, he says, rip it out and toss it. Better for you to enter into life with a patch over your eye than with both eyes to be thrown into Gehenna. If your right hand's causing you sin, chop it off and throw it away. Better for you to enter into life maimed than with both hands to go to hell. The failure to cut out sinful behavior from our lives is, for Jesus, simply foolish. Sinning in such a way is cooperating with the devil. And what that would be like is if a businessman knew that his competition were trying to destroy his company, that he would give the owner of the other company the vice presidency in his own, so that from the inside he would be able to make the company fail. A lot of the times, though, that's what we do when we start negotiating with the devil, who wants to do to us what he did to Adam and Eve. That won't really be a sin. Look at how many people are doing it. In this story, Jesus is telling us to use our heads, to be smart about salvation, and he knows we're capable of it. In the final analysis, our bottom line is to be saved. God tells us in today's second reading through St. Paul that he desires all of us to be saved. He desires you and me to be saved. But he who created us without our help refuses to save us without our help. We must choose to follow down the path he trod, down the way of loving and serving him and loving and serving others. Jesus' words today in the gospel are like a top-notch group of business consultants who come in to analyze a failing business, find out where the inefficiencies are, and design a business plan not only to save the company, but to make it thrive. But the key is not that you just have the report, that you have the information of what you need to do. The key is having the wisdom, the courage, and the resolve to implement that plan. And that's what Jesus is trying to show us today. That we've got to follow his plan, not just know about it. He's saying that to say yes to God means to say no to whatever is incompatible to a life with God in this world and the next. That to say yes to God means to use our heads and orient everything we do toward that meeting with Him face to face when we're going to have to render an account of our stewardship. Unlike in the parable today, when we meet Jesus face to face, we're not going to be given time to go back and fix things. The time will be up. Jesus, though, is giving us the time to fix them right now. If we've been selfish with our gifts, if we haven't been putting God first, now's the time to be wise enough to do so. If we've been trying to compromise with a particular sin, with something that's obviously wrong but which we're trying to deny, the time to change is now, today. Now's the time for us to be as shrewd about storing up for ourselves heavenly wealth as Donald Trump and Warren Buffett are to increase their billions here on earth. We can't serve both God and money, Jesus tells us emphatically. We're called to choose. And what's it going to be? It's going to be storing up treasure forever or monopoly money? Are we going to try to come to the eternal mansion Christ has prepared for us in His Father's bosom? Or are we going to put little plastic pieces on Park Street? That's the choice. We can't have both. I repeat, we can't have both. And if anyone thinks that we can, we're in the grip of the father of lies. We can't have both. So what's it going to be? Just as the steward in the parable couldn't keep all his commission and win the favor of those who owed him, so we can't save our life and squander our gifts. This parable today is Jesus' way to shake us out of our complacency. Sometimes we Catholics can think that by the fact that we come to Sunday Mass, we pray each day, we don't outright break the letter of the commandments, that everything's fine in our relationship with God. Our first reading today warns us, however, that our prayer, that our Sunday Mass attendance, that all the commandments are to make us charitable like Jesus is charitable. And unless we become charitable, we still might lose it all. That's what happened with the Israelites, as the prophet Amos told them. They kept the Sabbath. They paid 10% of their material goods to the temple. They said their prayers 3 times a day. But after they had done all of these things, they weren't really changed to the level God wanted them to be changed. They thought that after the Sabbath was done, they were free to do exactly as they wanted and live the rest of their lives as they pleased. Amos tells us they couldn't wait for the Sabbath to end so that they could now engage in immoral practices like cheating the poor Sunday through Friday. They were fixing their scales in order to rip people off. They were taking advantage of those temporarily unable to pay their debts, like a ruthless money lender who forecloses a mortgage after a single missed payment so that he can buy the property himself at a fraction of its real worth. Amos's condemnation of these outwardly religious but deeply dishonest people is unforgettable. The Lord has sworn, "Never will I forget a thing they have done." Whatever we do to the least of our brothers and sisters, we do to God. When we sacrifice for them, God will never forget. But when we stiff them, just pretending to be Christian, God won't forget that either. We're always going to have to render an account. The poor are our bankers. If we wish our material goods to help us pass the final accounting, then we must shrewdly use them to help others now. Today at this Mass, we're installing the offices of the Knights of Columbus. And I would strongly encourage every man here, if you wish to be shrewd about your salvation, join the Knights. They will help you to become better Catholic men. If you want to help your family members become better Christians, join the Knights. It'll help you to become better husbands and better fathers, to try to inspire them and draw them to the faith. If you wish to be a better citizen, to use the gift of our American citizenship well, join the Knights. It'll help you to become truly patriotic and learn how to serve your country. Be shrewd about these things. Don't say, if I join the Knights, I'll miss 2 Red Sox games a month. Be prudent about what really matters. The Knights will help you to learn that type of sacred savviness. The time for our accounting is on its way. For some of us, even sooner than we would ever expect, perhaps even today. The Lord calls us urgently and always to be ready to render an account by living lives consistent with His self-giving love rather than with self-centered selfishness. If we're faithful in small things, He tells us, we will be faithful in big things. The small things of day-to-day life, at home, at work, at school, driving, at the supermarket, in service and volunteering. If we're faithful in these little things, we'll become strong to remain faithful until the end. But if we blow those little things off as opportunities just for ourselves and not for God, it's then that we risk going bankrupt forever. How do we really grow? What would be the most intelligent practices? The first would be prayer, in which we allow the Lord to guide us to be good stewards. The second would be by a regular spiritual audit, examining our consciences each night before we go to bed and coming frequently to the great merciful debt forgiveness business we call the sacrament of confession. And third, through praying and living the Mass in a holy way. Here at Mass, each week or even each day, we learn from Jesus Himself how to put God above material things and how to make of our entire life a commentary on the words of consecration, learning how to do this in Jesus' memory and sacrifice ourselves for others. Today, the Lord, whom we're about to receive, wants to help us to imitate His wisdom and His way of life, so that when it comes time for us to render an account of all the blessings He has given us, He might be able to praise us eternally for acting wisely. Let us become as pure as a dove while being as shrewd as a serpent. That is our Christian call, to be a children of the light, so that one day He will be able to praise His beloved sons and daughters for being smarter with earning what amasses an eternal treasure than the most greedy businessman is in earning another million. He's prepared to give us all the help we need to do that, but let's ask Him for His assistance to follow that business plan, the Father's business. Amen.